You're listening to the Cash and Burn podcast, and I'm your host, Brandon Metcalf. Join me as I interview and have conversations with founders and leaders about the greatest obstacles and challenges they've faced while building their businesses. Learn how they overcame them and ultimately what made them successful. The podcast is brought to you by Place. Place is a B2B SaaS customer subscription management, billing, forecasting, and metrics platform powered by Salesforce. Growing SaaS businesses use Place to better align their revenue and finance teams so they can boost revenue growth and retention, manage renewals, collect cash faster, and make more informed decisions all directly inside of Salesforce. Hey everyone, welcome back to Cash and Burn. Excited to have James Gastine today, the co-founder and CEO of Uneric. Did I say that right? Uneric? Uneric?
You did. You did. That's the way.
I'm terrible about butchering names and names of companies, so forgive me. But I'm glad you're on. We know each other for a little while now. We play in the same ecosystem. I think we have a lot of similar point of views on different things, so this is going to be a fun conversation. But welcome, and why don't you kick off by telling everyone who you are?
Yeah, appreciate it, Brandon, and thanks for having me on the show. So I've been in the Salesforce space for about 13 years, which in Europe is a very long time indeed. And I think I kind of sleptwalked my way into the Salesforce ecosystem, and everyone's got their story of how they ended up there. And the co-founder of my first business, Precursive, he was a technical consultant at Deloitte who started working on one of the largest ever rollouts in Europe, Sony PlayStation. He'd gone to Dreamforce in 2010, and he'd seen the light. He came like a zombie, you know, having drunk the Kool-Aid, and said, James, we've got to build on Salesforce. There's this thing called the cloud and SaaS, and everyone's going on about it in Silicon Valley. So we've got to jump on that bandwagon. And that was really how we kind of started in the Salesforce space, by building an app on the Salesforce platform, which, you know, in Europe in 2010 was probably a little bit crazy because everyone was either getting, you know, servers off Rackspace and then having a whole DevOps team to build a product together. So it was just me and him really that got it off the ground, which was really great fun. And we kind of did a couple of pivots and ended up being in the kind of resource planning space, where we were kind of scratching the itch of you know, the pain we'd seen in the kind of consulting world with an app based on Salesforce. And our thinking at the time was, you know, if sales is really thinking about, you know, the demand for resources, then really if you have resource planning bolted onto it, that's demand, and you can kind of bring it together. So really, you know, when we were at Deloitte, we would see that there was like four systems to answer a pretty simple question, which is, you know, who's available and when can they start? And believe it or not, it was SAP, spreadsheet, homegrown system, and something else to answer that. So we thought there must be a better way, and that's how we kind of got started. And really kind of what we saw along the journey was that, you know, we would kind of specialize in the kind of the resource planning space and often kind of like partnering with others. And I think one of the interesting things that we saw as we started to grow and the market started getting more mature is that in kind of 2014, 2015, you started seeing already a little bit of a consolidation theme in the Salesforce you know, ecosystem, definitely around things where, you know, Steelbrick acquired a small British outfit called WeInvoiceIt to kind of, you know, compete against Aptus, quickly then got acquired by then Salesforce. So we started to see this kind of like this slow consolidation theme around kind of 8 years ago. And really, I think, you know, for Precursive, what we saw was in about, you know, 2016, 2017, we'd have customers and prospects coming to us with requirements for typically things that we didn't do. So we would partner up. And in 2016, 2017, that worked pretty well. And then in 2018, we kind of saw that prospects wanted kind of one throat to choke. So they really wanted to deal with one vendor, one contract, one support, one account manager, right? And really off that basis with kind of, you know, Precursive, we did a lot of work with TaskFeed, which is, you know, at the time was like a British equivalent of TaskRay. I reached out to the founder, Andy, and said, hey, what do you think about bringing our two companies together? You know, we do resource planning, you do project management, we've got a shared customers together, we're both in the UK, we're both pretty scrappy, you know, we'd probably be a lot stronger together. So we did a very much do-it-yourself merger, and hey presto, we were a bigger company overnight. We then ran into this thing called COVID, which meant that things like face-to-face conferences and taking your customers out became very hard. But however, even during that kind of COVID period, we saw the cross-sell, so customers buying both products, increase dramatically, right? So that is a huge light bulb moment, which is like, wow, if you can bring together apps on the Salesforce platform around a common persona, a common process, you can actually drive a lot of very efficient growth by extending the value you provide to your customer as opposed to just trying to acquire net new customers all the time. And that really was a bit of the background and genesis for starting Unoric, which was kind of, you know, really scratching again my personal itch around being a bootstrapped entrepreneur for so long, but also thinking about, you know, how can you be part of something slightly bigger when you go to market, as opposed to being a small, you know, literally independent ISV, who's most of them are bootstrapped, trying to gain the awareness and attention of Salesforce partners and customers. So that's a little bit of that kind of the background of kind of how I got to where we are. And really, you know, at Unoric, what we're looking to do, Brandon, is build the largest suite of apps on the Salesforce platform. And we're doing that through a combination of acquiring products, but also through building them out ourselves. And the way we think about this is products really sitting in kind of what we call clusters that have a common central customer theme. So the first one is really thinking around RevOps and revenue operations. So really everything from kind of data through to the kind of customer being acquired. And, you know, you might have seen the press announcements just before London World Tour, where we kind of announced and launched. And again, SalesBolt is one of the first companies in the fold. And that's got a couple of products that are in the, you know, the kind of RevOps and SalesOps space. And again, they play nicely with the symbol, one of your businesses. So again, we've got this kind of vision of building out a suite of more what I call point solutions that we can put together so that we can actually extend the value to customers, but also they're dealing with one vendor with a consistent kind of experience. So really thinking about RevOps on the one hand. The next piece we're looking at is really thinking around post-customer acquisition, so services, CS, and that whole motion, where again, Service Cloud's getting a lot of traction because, you know, obviously the sales teams are slightly limited in terms of their growth for that market, whereas the service, you know, the Service Cloud TAM is really kind of growing nicely. And our third cluster is thinking really around kind of DevOps and system admin tools, so light touch tools that, you know, mostly everybody needs to keep their Salesforce orgs well-watered and well-maintained. And again, we're able then to think about how they fit flexibly together. In terms of how we think about that evolving, we're going to then start, you know, really aligning with Salesforce and the wider ecosystem by having verticalized go-to-markets already with, you know, for example, with a symbol, one of your companies, we're thinking there around staffing and recruitment and how do our companies align and build ecosystems. So either we build the ecosystems where we may own the products or we partner a lot more closely. And I think, you know, partnering up and building those ecosystems, I think it is the key to being successful in the Salesforce space.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, our experiences are very similar. I mean, I started building Talent Rover in 2009 in the US, and I can imagine how challenging it was starting to build in the UK in 2010, because it certainly was the wild, wild west of figuring out how to build things. And Salesforce really didn't understand it super well. I mean, it was a whole different journey back then, which now is definitely more professionalized. And I like some of the big things that have rolled out really over the past year or two. I think they've made some significant changes to building on it. But, you know, the whole philosophy that we have at Assemble, since you mentioned it, is a very similar approach, right? Where, you know, Talent Rover, we were a platform, we're a full solution where you had to use everything that we offered. So, you know, staffing and recruiting software. So you had to use our ATS, you had to use our timesheet system, you had to use, you know, whatever vendor we selected for search and match. You had to basically use how we said you should use Salesforce, which worked at the time. But now I think the approach is very different, where people want flexibility and people want the direct relationship with Salesforce. So you get to use all the cool stuff that Salesforce is doing, which a lot of those other platform vendors prevent you just by the nature of how it's designed. So I'm excited to what you guys are doing, especially in the areas that you're focused on. Definitely excited about the relationship that we have with SalesBolt so far. I think it's a pretty cool positioning of combining what that product does with what we're trying to do. So excited to see where that can go. We're obviously both at Dreamforce this week, which is, you know, the motherland of all things Salesforce. So it's going to be as crazy as it always is. Although it'll be interesting to see how it is compared to last year. Last year was not nuts with 40,000 people all crammed into like a block radius. So this should be a bit different. But, you know, the areas of focus that you're focused on are interesting. So like the RevOps piece, obviously I play in that space as well, on a different side of that space with what we do at Place, with more connecting RevOps to finance. So I think that's a really, really hot segment of Salesforce, because you see so many Salesforce consulting firms trying to build it, which is, I think, always an interesting thing when you're looking at the Salesforce ecosystem to say, where are the consulting firms building stuff? Because that's a need. The staffing piece, you know, our relationship there. But then I was really interested in like the Service Cloud and that whole side of it, because it is on fire. So like, is it the work that you guys were doing at Percursive that made you think about the services side, or like what attracted you to that bubble?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So I think there's a couple of things, right? So we always look at the kind of the bigger picture. So really, you know, UNIRIC has been kind of under the bonnet or tinkering away for a number of years now. And really, you know, I think with the change of the economy shifting from kind of, right, you know, how many Salesforce seats, you know, Sales Cloud seats can Salesforce sell? Well, maybe there's some rip and replace, but that's probably going to be dependent on the number of salespeople in the market. And that's being reduced with the economy. And I think there's a few kind of things that's happening really interesting with services. So there's a couple of themes around kind of thinking around like this bring your own theme, right? So there's this bring your own channel theme, right? So you may be running a service center, but again, like you said before with the ATS analogy, instead of being told, okay, here's your phone system and here's, you know, here's Service Cloud with case management, it's like, okay, well, here's your phone system. Here's your Service Cloud and case management system. But in these countries, you're using these channels here, right? So in China, you might use WeChat. You might use WhatsApp in these countries. You may use normal messaging. You may use phone. You may use VoIP. You may use this phone system. You may use video. So all of a sudden, this idea of, you know, bring your own devices, bring your own channels, bring your own comms, for example, I think is this big theme in the service center that's really kind of catching on. And I think we're seeing it with some quite exciting things around, you know, translation, right? So all of a sudden, you know, talking about consolidation earlier, big and enterprise, I think, great, how do we have single kind of customer centers around certain time zones? Well, what happens when you have translation issues and someone's typing and texting and you've got maybe AI and then a human being behind the scenes? And again, it's just bring your own translation system, bring your own channels. So really, we see that as the service kind of cloud being the center of that side of things, because again, you've acquired the customer, you want to look after it. So that's really where we kind of see those kind of nice rising tides. And I think there's also quite a lot of there, which has got, you know, thinking around, you know, how do you extend into other parts of the organization? So again, in some industries that I'm aware of, for example, in telecoms, you know, there's a huge penetration for Service Cloud, but not for Sales Cloud, right? So again, in some instances, maybe they're using Siebel, other legacy CRM providers. But again, Service Cloud has been this kind of Trojan horse for Salesforce to get into big organizations that, you know, they've been able to run up sales pipeline and report on it because they're a listed company. But when it comes to managing the customer relationship, it's on-premise, legacy tools, things falling together, you know, falling apart. So again, that's where we kind of see that Service Cloud and really thinking around that kind of, you know, that area there. And I'd say kind of another point is, if you think about some of the big sectors that Salesforce are in terms of industries, so, you know, things like tech, right? And one of the things that always used to baffle me is, you know, if you look at the amount of the money that customers are spending, for example, on CRM, how much are they spending on customer success platforms, right? So I pulled some data a year or two ago, and I think it was, you know, whatever, it was 3 or 4 billion on Sales Cloud. And then, you know, one of the larger products out there, Gainsight, you know, annual ARR was about 100 billion. So it's like, okay, well, where are people going to run customer success, right? You know, if they're in B2B and they need to look after customers, how are they doing it? So, you know, is that an opportunity? And I think some of the answer was people were doing it themselves, right? And just custom configuring and saying, great, we will create a little trigger that will create a renewal opportunity in 12 months. Well, that's not customer success, right? That's not going to guarantee you renewal just because you've got a trigger. So, you know, we feel there's a lot of white space there between what people might be doing, for example, on the sales side on the platform, but then in life with their customers.
Well, and I think it's why the customer 360 approach that Salesforce rolled out a bit ago is the right approach, and it's smart. And I said, like, when they bought Slack and they were getting a lot of Slack for buying Slack, I was like, this is the most important acquisition they've ever done. Like, because it really, in my mind, solidifies, like, this is an operating platform to cover all areas of the business. It's not just the CRM or not just this. And Slack becomes the communication hub, which is the most important thing with running a business, is how do you communicate about everything that's going on? So I think they continue to make some really interesting steps, which is exciting in the partner ecosystem, because if you can figure out a true pain that you really solve and in, you know, how you deliver outcomes and how you evangelize those outcomes to potential customers, then all of a sudden you have a meaningful for product in the ecosystem, which I know is one of your big hot areas of things that you've learned over the years from being in the ecosystem about going to market and how to position yourself and all that. Because there's, what, 4,000, 5,000 apps now on the AppExchange? And
yeah, 4,000 plus.
Yeah,
exactly. It's 4,000, yeah. I think you're right. So I think, you know, it's almost become a victim of its own success where, you know, Salesforce through its kind of community-based, you know, culture and visions, there's probably quite a lot of apps out there, but we know, we've looked through them, you know, that probably haven't been updated a number of years, haven't been updated to Lightning. But again, you're not really going to go and fire your partners. That won't send the right message around the Salesforce ecosystem. But there's a lot of very good kind of point solutions. And again, going back to kind of the theme that I was talking about at the start, is that, you know, really there's this theme of kind of consolidation that was being driven by customers, right? So I know it beforehand, you know, I've had it before when I was at Precursive, where, you know, customers, they want a single kind of vendor. And I think that kind of theme is only really going to become more prevalent, right? So, you know, customers saying, look, I don't want this narrow integration point. I'm not putting, you know, I'm Coca-Cola USA. I'm not putting my credit card in to buy this product, right? We don't do things around here. We need a purchase order. We need account management. We need time zone support for Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. So there are certain kind of things that we need. It might be Salesforce and you've passed security review, but there's a certain level of other items that we need, right? So we can kind of see this theme of consolidation really being driven initially by customers, I'd say, is about, you know, 4 or 5 years old in terms of a theme. And I think you can also kind of see it in the market, in the wider SaaS marketplace. So again, through COVID, a lot of people raised a lot of money at pretty silly valuations in 2020, 2021. And, you know, not everyone hit their milestones, right? So you're then seeing consolidation through vendors and startups and scale-ups needing new homes, right? And you're starting to see kind of, you know, for example, I saw an article this morning around Gong and this kind of revenue intelligence space. And again, there's mini consolidation there. There's 5 players in the Salesforce space, because again, to be a missing part of the jigsaw didn't make sense when you had 5 people or 5 vendors pre-IPO with loads of funding really racing to that kind of NASDAQ finish line, right?
Yeah. Well, and you just thought Clary just bought Groove.
Exactly. That was the one that was announced. Exactly. So you've got Clary, you've got Gong, you've got Apollo, you've obviously got Zoom, you know, there's some of those bigger guys. So it's then, you know, if you are a smaller vendor in that space, life's going to become quite hard. So, you know, maybe you miss your milestones, you become part of that business through a transaction. Maybe it's, you know, a good news story. So again, we're starting to see that, you know, consolidation is what I'd say is maybe category consolidation, where again, there's not this desire to have all these different apps and vendors. And I think that's even more so in the Salesforce space, where again, we know it when we were kind of, you know, doing a lot of research for Inaric, as we spoke to, say, folks at Salesforce, who are telling us that, you know, one of the pain points or what's in the feedback they get from customers is really just the variability of service and support from the AppExchange partners, right? Because again, all the feedback goes back to Salesforce. And again, you've got some partners that might innovate, keep up with the roadmap, documentation, support, and somewhere it's a bit patchy and scrappier, right? So again, that kind of inconsistency in terms of how maybe some of the ISV partners operate and deliver service and support is something that's kind of going back to kind of Salesforce. So we're kind of seeing that as part of that, you know, kind of consolidation theme. And really, it's, you know, when you're looking at the market and thinking a few years out, it's if you've got consolidation from the buyer side, consolidation from the vendor side, then really, you know, what's going to happen to the AppExchange market? You know, I think we're going to see it probably, you know, consolidate and shrink because, again, there's going to be folks who either, you know, form part of those consolidating. They might find some space themselves, a nice niche themselves. But again, I don't think there's room really for 4,500 apps out there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of those apps come to market and, you know, one of my companies, Blueprint, we're a PDO. So we actually help other companies build Salesforce-based apps or companies. And, you know, one of the services that we talk with these partners or these customers is you can't walk into the Salesforce ecosystem and just go, oh, Salesforce is just going to give me all the deals, and you know, they're just going to want to work with me because I solve problems and all that. And that mindset, I think, is prevalent with a lot of companies that try to get into the ecosystem, and that is like the polar opposite of how it actually works. I mean, this is a company built on trust, and it's not just words that they throw out. They actually, it is a company built on trust. And to your point of what you were talking about, as far as all these apps and app exchange partners not delivering for Salesforce in a consistent, meaningful way, I think that it's made the challenge for ISVs without a reputation to really get the traction that they need, because Salesforce has to trust you. Like, yep. Why would they bring you into the deal and open risk when they don't know you?
Exactly. And I think that's part of this kind of playing the game. And it's this kind of quite tricky bit of, okay, you need some kind of traction, some proof points, which is, you know, it's a startup, right? So it's like any other startup, it's hustle and grit. And I think, you know, if I look back in my first business, one of maybe the breakthrough points was, you know, we'd often build good relationships with AEs, be a safe pair of hands. There were certain kind of rules on the road around pricing and, you know, respecting who's running a deal. But I remember, I think it was like 2015, we did quite a large deal, probably our first six-figure deal. And obviously, you know, with the PNR, a chunk of that hit the AE. It happened to hit an AE's Q2 or Q3 quota, for example, and it kind of moved the dial for that individual, right? So, you know, we were on emails with the RVP, with all the sales engineers, and literally over the weekend, we were, you know, not called in, but kind of invited to present to the rest of the team. And really, I remember the RVP was like, you know, meet James. He's made one of your colleagues X thousand dollars, right, in this quarter. They're a safe pair of hands. Here's his pre-sales guy. Here's all the documentation. You know, make sure you give him some attention. And again, it's realizing that, you know, okay, you need some proof points, right? So you can be a safe pair of hands, but you need to put some runs on the board. And I think the other bit as well that we started to kind of realize is, you know, with the whole kind of PNR model, it's great that, you know, customers, you know, that Salesforce, you know, get something back and they double count it. But it's also thinking about that kind of that bigger story. So again, some of the things that we were working towards in our case studies and customer success stories was saying, okay, well, we can kind of tell a story around how we helped an AE make X amount more in their quarter, right? You know, great, that helps the AE. Maybe he or she tells their friends or colleagues. But the real one that we started to do with Precursive and get some traction on was maybe talking about how a prospect chose Salesforce as their platform because of us, right? So again, we had a couple of these customer success stories where customers were looking to do multiple things in one go on day one, right? So that's probably an evolution of Salesforce. You've probably seen, Brandon, where, you know, 15 years ago, people were buying CRM and that was it. Whereas now they're buying Sales Cloud, they're buying ISVs, they're buying maybe a couple of other clouds, Slack, MuleSoft, putting it together as part of a digital transformation or really upgrading their IT estate. And again, telling that story of, look, okay, we were part of either this winning deal or prospect, you know, prospect A picked, you know, the platform because of us, right? And then all of a sudden, it's a much bigger story and you get taken places. So again, I think it's just thinking about, you know, there are a set of rules, some are explicit, some are implicit, but it's that kind of mutual thing. How do you make Salesforce successful, right? So again, you know, delivering on quality, being consistent, having the right assets, doing the kind of the homework, but then also thinking about, right, you know, how do we actually kind of move the dial? How do we get famous here, right? And again, it can be through, you know, being a missing piece of jigsaw for a bigger deal and then delivering upon it.
Yeah, that's what makes it hard. It's also what makes it, I think, fun. It's why I love the ecosystem so much, because it's now complicated. It's not just you go out and building a reputation for your company. It's you have to do that. You have to have customers that love what your product does and that you actually deliver meaningful outcomes that they can really talk about and that you can quantify and demonstrate. You also have to build a relationship with Salesforce. And that's a full-time job on itself of, you know, why, how, who, all of that, plus the constant changing that Salesforce goes through every year with reaccount planning and all. I mean, it's a massive undertaking. And then tapping into like the third, because I look at, like, to go to market for Salesforce ISV, so a company built on Salesforce, I think you have three categories. I think you have your direct channel, so you going outbound, trying to find your own customers, all of that. Salesforce is a channel, and then Salesforce Partners is your third channel. And how do you leverage all three in a meaningful way to really drive the right awareness, which is, it's a complex orchestra to execute on. But if you do it, it can be really meaningful.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is the bit, again, you know, is that kind of like, you know, how do you get awareness right in quite a busy marketplace? Because so I used to work at Deloitte, and I remember talking to one of the partners, and he said, look, James, my target's 3-4 million, whatever it was a year. If you can bring me 10 million of that as a service wrapper, I might take your phone call. And so it was like, okay, this is the level of kind of, you know, this individual, this partner director has got a certain amount of billable days they need to sell, right? If I can take some off his or her quota, great. But if it's anything less than that, and I think this is where I see a lot of folks maybe struggle with, you know, oh, we have an enterprise solution, great. Who are the partners? Oh, we've got SMB, you know, SI consulting partner. Hang on a minute. That enterprise will probably have some global system integrators on their books, right? Who are almost gatekeepers for the account. So you're going to have to work with them. These SIs won't get through that hurdle. So you've then got to think about, right, who's the end customer and then who those partners are to get there and having those aligned. And I think the tricky bit then is then thinking about the incentives, right? Because if you're going to market through the SI channel, they need to, it has to be sufficiently worth their while for them to partner up, right? And to, you know, co-market and even deliver the product and get enabled on it. Because again, they've probably got huge horizontal, well-funded players out there who are probably paying for enablement and flying them to Dreamforce and shows. Whereas again, you know, slightly smaller ISV partners may struggle then to say, well, actually we've got an enterprise use case and they're using they're spending six figures with us, great. But the service wrappers, you know, 10, 20K, which again, won't move the needle for that partner. So I think it's really thinking about, you know, when you've got those three channels that you mentioned, thinking about, you know, how you partner up to target what size of customer.
Yep. And, you know, that then quantifies where you can spend money, where you can't spend money, where you have to spend sweat equity, and how do you pull this thing off to make it work? And it all, in my opinion, does come down to the relationships and trust throughout those three channels to really solidify it. Well, we're at Dreamforce this week, and the big theme of Dreamforce is, you know, AI plus data plus CRM, which I think is so telling with everything that's going on in the world, especially around AI. You know, how are you thinking about, I guess I'll ask this a different way. I always ask a question on the show. You know, what do you think founders and execs should be focused on is like the question I always ask. And I kind of know where you're going to go with this based off of just some of our previous conversations, but you know, what are you thinking right now? Like, where should we be focused?
So I think, you know, if I think from a founder perspective, right, there's a lot of innovation kind of in the platform and coming out. And I think you really got to think about, you know, how are you going to like incorporate some of that into your roadmap, right? And really thinking about doing that in a meaningful way with convictions. There's no point in saying, hey, we've got AI and we're going to summarize your, you know, your sales opportunity. No one cares. It's already summarized, right? So you can brag about AI. So I think it's really thinking about, you know, how are you going to like include AI in a very meaningful way for an outcome that's going to move the dial, right? And again, a bit like we spoke about it earlier, it's, you know, I definitely see this kind of use of AI will almost probably be a filter on the App Exchange like Classic and Lightning was 6-7 years ago, saying, hey, you know, here's companies that use AI, here's companies that don't, right? And I can imagine customers saying, well, look, if I'm going to have to ask my end users to type things into a Salesforce field, it's not going to get used. So I'm not even going to look at that. I'm going to exclude that. And I think that's really going to be a key bit, which is going to be like, how do you help the end users and your customers with kind of really kind of automation and productivity, right? If you really boil it down, like how are you going to make them more productive? And I think, you know, really taking a long, hard look, you know, as a founder, your product or product sets and saying, okay, you know, will my users be using this product in 6 to 12 months down the line when maybe these aspects are automated, right? There's automation across maybe like the whole sales funnel. So when we're looking, for example, when we look at companies, for example, in the RevOps space, what we get excited about is, okay, is there a play around data and automation? Because if we get that bit right, AI is really easy. If we're trying to tell a customer that they're kind of subpar data at the on opportunity stage, which is a mixture of, you know, hand typed and pick lists, right? Then we're going to do something clever with AI. We're probably not going to pass the sniff test. So again, what we like to think about is, okay, you know, getting the data bit's quite important. So thinking about what are those use cases for, you know, data, maybe there's an external data into Salesforce to enrich it. It builds trust with the customers. you wrap automation and AI around it, then you can start to think about the patterns. But if you're running the AI on pretty crappy data, I don't know to what extent customers will trust that. So I think, yeah, to reiterate that, it's going to be thinking around, how do product managers, founders think about the AI bit? Because it's going to be a key piece where I can imagine customers and deals will be, are you using this functionality in your product? Very much like it was with Einstein, for example, which was, have you got a use case for Einstein? So again, partners that have got really good use cases that can demonstrate the platform will be the winners. Those that, don't have it or skip out on it or think that their customers will carry on punching words and text and data into, Salesforce fields, they're going to find life a lot harder.
Yeah, and I think it's smart. Like, I think because everyone's trying to figure out AI right now, and some people are just throwing things against the wall to see what sticks. I think the companies that are very intentional with, here is how we actually improve someone's workflow by eliminating things they just don't need to be doing, I think those are going to be the ones that win. It's even interesting to see how Salesforce has rolled out all of its GPT stuff, where unlike what they normally do, which is big bang, like let's go everywhere, like they've been very specific about doing very specific things with their GPT products and doing more of a gradual rollout, but focusing on solving specific things that, for automation, which I think is really, really smart. So, we are out of time. I told you it was going to go by fast and it did. looking forward to hanging out with you this week in San Francisco.
Definitely. Look forward to it.
Thanks for coming on. I think what you guys are doing is really interesting. This consolidation play of the App Exchange is going to be fun to see how it all shakes out, because it's definitely happening. So, but thank you. Thanks for coming on.
Great. Thanks a lot, Brendan. Bye now.
Everyone else, Cash and Burn comes out every Tuesday. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.